Game On 2FF with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Thanks to Jenny Green. It's a wintry evening in Kildare, but it is the 13th of October and this is Game On.
Coming up today, it's a budget-free zone, but COVID-19 is still dominating. Mark Langdon fills us in on a positive test for one of the greats.
And then Ronaldo! Oh!
So nobody is immune. But anyway, we'll also have Leicester City's former chairman to explore the project big picture plan, and in GAA, with their side down 17 players due to COVID regulations, Fermanagh request postponement of their league game with Clare.
That's a lot forgot about in this pandemic, that these lads have actually contracted something, and like, people think, oh no, we'll get the 10 boys back. But like, I can't expect 10 players to come back and play a National League game. Any conversations I've had with them is that they're totally, totally wrecked. They're totally gone. Any bit of movement at all, they can't go. It's actually a bit scary. And
it is indeed. Plus, we've the latest from Declan Quigley on a very strange Giro d'Italia.
Game On 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. So the budget may have been flush, but like the senior team, the Ireland under-21s can't seem to score a goal either. Italy have just beaten them 2-0 in the Euro qualifier this afternoon in Pisa in Italy. And when you look at it, Ireland had 60% of the possession. They had way more passes, way more pass accuracy, committed less fouls. But they had one less shot than the Italians, who managed to hit the target twice. Ireland hit the target twice, or had two shots on target, but they couldn't hit the net. Italy won by 2-0. Ricardo Saltiel in the 43rd minute and Patrick Coutrone in the 62nd minute. That leaves Ireland level on points with Italy in the group standings. Iceland are a point back, who have a game in hand, but that is against Italy, so who knows what will happen down the line. But ahead of tomorrow's big game, it seems to be the same story. All the possession, all the ball, but no goals.
Bring back Robbie Keane. I think that's what the Irish soccer needs, isn't it?
We can't stick him in the under-21s. When Italians feel at the under-20s, if only they could have fielded the under-18s or something like that, it might have been a bit more of a help as well. But disappointment for them in Pisa. But such is life. And of course, the senior team did depart this morning for Helsinki. But I think it was more about who wasn't on the plane than who was.
Yeah, it's been a very chaotic build-up to this game, and actually all the games, really, when you think about it, if you even just go through who hasn't made it. So Stephen Kenny's going to be without John Egan, Callum Robinson, Callum O'Dowda, Alan Brown and Derek Williams after they missed Sunday's draw with Wales. Dave McGoldrick is out with an injury. Aaron Connolly is back. Adam Ida, who missed the Slovakia game and had returned from Wales, is also back. Then you have Daryl Shea, Jason Knight, Ryan Manning, Ronan Curtis, all been drafted into the squad for the game in Helsinki as well. And then you have another player, an unnamed player as well, who is out after testing positive for the coronavirus. And then you've James McLean, who is suspended after that red card. So there is a huge amount going on, and a lot of the conversation building up to this, it hasn't even really been about the lack of goals, it's been about the COVID.
Well, we're always challenging managers to try new players, and I guess it's really been forced upon Stephen Kenny, isn't it? Who knows who he's going to put on the pitch. It'll be interesting for him, but not an ideal start for Stephen, and hopefully things will turn around for him. He deserves a change in look, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. Ruby Marie, it makes me worry about international sport. We just seen in rugby that the Gloucester scrum half, Stephen Varney, who he's Welsh-born, but he qualifies for Italy, so he's met up, getting preparations ready for the Ireland-Italy game, the rescheduled Six Nations match, and he has tested positive for COVID. And it just makes me think that, you know, when we have these international, when you have people coming from different clubs, different environments, it is very hard to manage that.
Yeah, well, there was a review conducted by the FAI about how they would cope with travelling, and obviously there was issues with where players sat in the plane. Stephen Kenny did a press conference today and he spoke about the flight arrangements.
Yeah, there was some differences. But again, that would be, you know, mainly the operations director would mainly plan that in relation to with all the senior management. So I think I spoke to him yesterday in relation to the flight plan. So we did change some things, but these are things that everyone is learning. You know, there are no experts at the moment in this, because it's a real learning curve for so many people. It's a real learning curve for everyone, really. So, there will be changes, I would think, going forward.
I think he was bang on there when he said that it's a real learning curve, and we're all even trying to get to grips with what all of the testing results means. We've had positives, we've had negatives, we've had false positives, and then we've had negatives and positive followed by positives. And Kenny himself, it said that he is keeping the faith in the testing system.
Well, I think, it's hard to believe that we lost two players because of the playoff. You know, at such a late stage, because of a false positive, connected to contact tracing. So I think obviously the rules, and if it was a Dutch player, for example, a player from Holland, he wouldn't have had a problem because their rules are 1.5 metres. If it was a player in England, they wouldn't have had a problem, but Ireland, the HSC rules are much more stringent than the health authorities in Ireland, much more stringent than anywhere else in Europe, I think. So I think other countries wouldn't have been deemed as contact tracing, but in our country we have to abide by the law, and that's what the medical department did.
You would imagine, though, Marie, when you think about it, they're getting on the plane and don't like 2 metres apart. You'd imagine they would definitely put the players 2 metres apart, wouldn't you, from each other, and then put the people that have to be there or needed and have other jobs to do a bit further forward on the plane, or whatever way they'd work it out. But the rules are the rules, and
the problem was that two of the players sat in the wrong seats, and I think that's the issue. But they have, from what I can gather, changed the way that they are operating on the plane now. So instead of keeping all the players together, they're keeping them apart. So initially they obviously thought, because this is so new, that if you keep all the players together, that it's pretty safe. But then you learn that, okay, if one player is positive and their players around him then become close contacts and miss out because of that. So they had to reassess the way they did things. And this is all trial and error. And I think you have to feel sorry for Stephen Kenny, because he's going into this as a new manager, like a new international manager. There's a huge amount of learn, and then you throw COVID in on top of that. And I know, look, things aren't going as well as we would like on the field, but at the same time there's a huge amount of disruption, and he spoke about that.
Listen, there are people experiencing far worse than we are at the moment. I think, you know, it's this coronavirus has been, you know, killed thousands of people throughout Europe and bigger numbers throughout the world. So it's you know, it's been bigger than sport. But I think for us, it did have an impact over the last... For example, we've had 8 players missing over the last week because of contract tracing. So, you know, for this week, 8 players. So that's been significant in we'd 8 players through contract tracing missing against Wales the other day. And we hadn't got, obviously, David McGoldrick and James McCarthy were injured. We already had Seamus Coleman and Harry Hart or Daryl Lennon out of the original squad. So we had 13 players unavailable for the game against Wales. So considering that, I think the players did remarkably well, considering 13 players were unavailable. And I think they did really well, and were unfortunate not to win, really.
C'est la vie. Unfortunate. But that contact tracing even is there for everybody. And I must say, Marie, or Donica, how many times do you get on a plane and you have a seat to sit in? Surely you sit in the seat.
No, you always, when it comes to rugby, you grab
went for
whatever,
the leg room.
Exactly. You grab whatever back you see sitting in the one with leg room, and you're there, out. Get out of it. Yeah, and it was actually, there was a great piece by John Fallon.
Good job I won on your team.
Yeah, exactly. You would have definitely been on the back. Actually, you'd be all right. Fellas like yourself and Rog sat where they wanted. So, but he was chatting to Tim Allnutt, the Connacht manager, about it. And he was saying, like, the process they put in place, making sure that tight heads didn't sit together because they are specialist positions. So they had to keep them apart. They had to take photographs of everyone where they were sitting on the two buses and the flight. They travelled on a day trip. trip. They didn't get the result, but you can see that the amount of work that's going into actually making teams even travel seems to be sizable at the moment, and it's a massive body of work.
It is huge. I even noticed it in the Wareham's in Ireland with the jockeys. They all have their names on the tables where they have to sit, so the IHRB can locate where everyone sat. Even when Shane Cross tested positive, they could then decide who was sitting in the square around him in those couple of metres, because everyone has an allocated seat. But luckily enough for the IHRB, they were able to read their own names and sit at the right tables.
We're going to be talking about Cristiano Ronaldo testing positive a little bit later with Mark Langdon, but he did tweet last night after the Portugal match a picture of himself sitting at dinner with the whole team, and everybody was sitting so close together. So I'd say it'll be
they're wishing they had the Ireland 2 metre rule.
I'd say they did. Now, I'm afraid, lads, there's no getting away from the COVID. We are going to move on to speak about GAA, and we will be starting with that because there have been some developments on the upcoming league games. Fermanagh GAA have lodged a request to the Central Competitions Control Committee for a postponement of their fixture against Clare and Ennis, and RT Sport also understands that Longford County Board have asked Croke Park to move their football game against Derry out of Derry City. With more on all of this, we are joined by Damien Lawler. So Damien, what is the latest on these developments?
Yeah, Marie, CCC meeting tonight, Central Competitions Controls Committee. They have a few requests to deal with ahead of the National the Allianz League starting on Sunday and Saturday. Longford put in a request early yesterday. They want their game against Derry played at a neutral venue. I was chatting to a couple of officials there yesterday, and they're not happy that they've got a low enough incidence rate of COVID-19. They've got to travel Derry where it's quite serious, and they don't want to go there effectively. They'd rather play it at a neutral venue. So they sent a letter into Croke Park yesterday looking for consideration for that game to be played at a neutral venue, and that will come up for the decision tonight at the CCCC meeting. You also have a scenario there where other counties are looking for stuff, like, as well as it's my information that Roscommon, I think they got to travel up north as well, and they're looking for maybe a neutral venue also. Fermanagh then, their county board, after about a week of intense scrutiny, they filed a letter, a request to Central Council, sorry, to the CCCC tonight also, looking for their game with Clare to be deferred. So they're different than the other counties. They want an actual deferral of that fixture because 10 of their players have tested positive for COVID-19 and 7 are in isolation. And at the moment, 11 players are training. And the players who have tested positive are not in great nick, certainly not up to playing a match, according to their manager, Ryan McMenamin. So a CCCC meets tonight and they've got requests like that. Wexford also are keeping an eye on a potential cluster that they've discovered as well from a certain part of the county down there. And I think Waterford have to go up to the tip of Ulster at the weekend as well. And I don't think they'd be totally enamoured with having to go up that journey, not the journey as such, but that it would be at a neutral venue because of the huge number of cases in Ulster, particularly in the north with COVID-19. So that's kind of the landscape ahead of tonight's meeting. They all have their requests before the CCCC, and I'm not so sure how successful any of those requests will be.
It's unprecedented, as we've said so many times, but for the CCC even to be in this position when it comes to health and safety, Damien, it's different than just overturning a red card.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and it's very unlikely, in my opinion, that Fermanagh will get that deferral. I think they've got two choices: to either play an under-20/B team, and when I say B team, I mean members of the extended panel that might not have found themselves in a starting position straight away, or else the forfeit the points to Clare. So there are the two options as I see it. I could not see the CCCC deferring that game. I think there's time pressures to get, you know. Most counties would avail of the two games in the league before the championship starts. Once the championship starts, it's nearly Zoom till Christmas. Unlikely there'll be a postponement there either, unless there's 13 days between games. So I think it's very messy. Nobody foreseen this. But I think the GAA are quite adamant, or at least they were right up to today, that no league games would be deferred or postponed, that the teams will have to forfeit the points.
Damien, what does a neutral venue achieve when you think about it? There's going to be no fans or no crowd. The players are going to be the very same players, whether they're playing in Derry or playing somewhere else. The referee is going to be the same person. Then surely the players aren't going to have any contact with the linesmen or the umpires. The dressing room can be sanitised or whatever else you would do with it. What does a neutral venue achieve? Yeah. They don't have to stop anywhere in Derry. They're surely going to the ground and straight in there.
Yeah, on this occasion, the argument would be that playing at a neutral venue where the incidence rate of COVID-19 positive cases is not as high is a safer environment for them to go into. So you think about it for a second, Ruby. A lot of the time, those journeys up north would be overnight. I think there's a huge reluctance for that to happen now. I think also you have to have your pre-match meal. All of you guys would know about that. In terms of for a 2 o'clock fixture, you want to be taking in your chicken and pasta at 10:30. And they're going to have to stop off somewhere for that, I would imagine. Even if it's in an outdoor environment, they're going to have to set up base there somewhere. And, you know, you have to get togged out and you have to get your strapping and you have to get your physio and your prehab done too before the game even starts. And from speaking to officers in those three or four counties, they would be a lot safer doing that at a neutral venue where the COVID positivity cases was not as prominent. However, it's been said by President John Horan that by taking a league game out of a home and away basis and putting it at a neutral venue will affect the integrity of the competition. So that's why I think that request won't have any success tonight, nor will Fermanagh's request for a deferral or a postponement.
Damien, I imagine it's peace of mind as well, you know, like if you're going to be travelling to a place where it is a high incidence and you're going into areas that, you know, you're just taking for granted really that they're sanitised to the level that they would be in other places up there. And also as well, like, you know, these people are going into work the next day. They're not in a bubble, so they have to go in with a clear mind as well that they have done as much as they can to keep everybody around them safe.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. That, I mean, that's what it is. It's peace of mind and it's the safety. Even the perception that things will be a bit easier to get into. Now, I mean, look at the reality is that in the north, in Ulster, in the west, and in the east, and in the south, every GAA county is doing their living best to keep this at bay and trying to keep sport going throughout this pandemic, which is astonishing, really, that we've got this far at all. And I think every county board is aware that they're going into maybe an environment whereby, you know, COVID cannot be directly traced back to that particular camp. But the fact of the matter is, especially up in Ulster at the moment, there's a lot of college students that actually go into college in person, and players have picked it up there. And, you know, they are playing with their counties, and it is in the communities up there. And it's down here as well. So there's no separation, but the numbers are drastically higher per capita up there than they are down here. So I think it's a sensitive one. There's no doubt about that. But I think it's a common sense stroke safety approach is what these counties are looking for. But at this stage, I'd say it's hard even to see neutral venues being agreed upon by the CCCC. And I think you're going to have the league games, the last two rounds played off. That will protect the integrity of that competition, I think. All the playoffs, relegation standings will be decided, and then you can go into the championship and maybe deal with that when it comes. But right now, you couldn't even look past this weekend with the whole thing.
Damien, the integrity stays because the competition was completed. But if you're playing against squad players in the under-20s, is it really, you know?
Yeah, fair point. And I mean, look, what the other side of it too is, Donica, for the last few years, inter-county managers have been carrying squads of up to 40 to 45 players. And I think this year with COVID, that's been brought right down to the mid-20s. And there's a tight rein put on that. And expenses and mileage are only going to be paid for 32 players. But I would feel that through third level competitions, through under 20, and through maybe the extended training panels that a lot of counties would carry, some guys would be prepared and would be up to a level to step right in. And at the end of the day, you've got six rounds of the National Leagues played at this stage. And I think there are just a few competitions where promotion and relegation results are necessary to see it out. So yeah, it's a fair point to make. I think COVID has actually dented the integrity of all competitions this year. You spent the first 10 minutes of the show discussing what's going on with the international soccer squad. I mean, Stephen Kenny said they were down 13 players at one stage. So, like, is the integrity of the Nations League and will Euro 2020 be affected integrity-wise as well? I think there's a fair chance it will. But I think maybe as far as trying to keep it as fair or as normal as possible, home and away arrangements, some people might disagree, but that looks to be the stance the GAA are holding.
Okay, so we will find out the results of that CCC meeting later on tonight. Now, Tammy, Encasement Park, which we've spoken about to you on several occasions, it has moved a little bit closer to completion, well, to even getting started, really. The Minister, the Northern Ireland Infrastructure Minister, Nicola Mallon, announced that she is recommending the approval of the plan to redevelop Casement Park.
Yeah, and like, I mean, I was chatting to the officials up there in Antrim, and they said to me, like, until they see a bulldozer or a mini digger on that field, until there's dirt being ploughed up. But no, I think they see it this time. This is massive. And look, within 3 to 6 months, I think there's a hope that you will see the diggers on that field. And there's also a feeling up around that area that that project could help restart or kickstart the economy. Because obviously, with the shortfall with the pandemic, there are glaring holes in finances everywhere, and maybe a project like this could get that area of Belfast going again. But by God, they've had to wait for this. 11 years, Ravenhill and Kingspan have both been redeveloped in that time. They've had many, many setbacks. I've covered it for so long. I actually, you know, speaking to the officials involved, be it Ulster Council or Antrim GEA or Club Antrim, you know, they've always been so frustrated, but they've been patient at the same time, because there was always a chink of light. But I think that kickstarting the economy, for one, and the fact that that area, Belfast needs a whole regeneration in terms of Gaelic games anyway, there's no doubt about that. There is a huge overspend now, there's no point in saying otherwise. 77 million sterling has gone to 110 million sterling. But the people involved in this project will say, well, that's not an overspend in our project, because we actually haven't got to start it yet. And don't forget too, guys, that part of the reason for the delay in all this was that there was no ministries in place, there was no local government there when Stormont stepped aside for that period of time. And before that then, it looked to be getting over the line where local residential objections held that process up as well. So to be fair to them, that initial costing of 77 million, that was the budget at the time. It's not through any fault of theirs that the project has been delayed. But I think it'll be a massive, massive boost to that area. And if I'm reading the form lines correctly, it just won't be a stadium for Gaelic games either. It'll be very, very inclusive, and there will be outside events coming in there too. So eventually in better times to come, it might be a massive boost for the economy, as we might yet see.
Well, it's something to look forward to anyway, Damien, because it has been so long in the making. We appreciate you taking our call, and we'll talk to you soon. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get to the fallout of Ronaldo's positive COVID test.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey and beef. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It has been a dramatic few days in football for COVID-19. Mark Langdon joins us now of the Racing Post. Mark, Ronaldo is the latest to contract the... Is it disease? Is that what we're calling it? To contract COVID-19 anyway. And it was a bit of a shock, because I think probably the way that Ronaldo carries on, you'd think he's invincible.
Obviously the most high profile player now to catch the virus. There is at least some good news. He was showing no symptoms, and all the other sort of players and staff that he was in close contact with have been tested, and then results have come back negative. But he's set for a spell on the sidelines anyway. Juventus are at Crotone on Saturday, and then the Champions League starts at sort of this time next week. So a blow for Juventus, obviously, just in the sporting front. Obviously for Ronaldo, it's not a nice situation for him, but it probably could have been worse. And these international matches that are being played at the moment, I think we'll look back on them and wonder whether they should have gone ahead, I think, in sort of years to come. And probably the answer is that they shouldn't. We're sending players not only all around Europe, they're going all around the world. South American World Cup qualifying going on at the moment. I'm just not sure it should be happening during a global pandemic.
Given that Juventus's chairman, Andrea Agnelli, is the head of the European Club Association, a pretty powerful club group, would you be confident that there will be more internationals next month?
I feel like they've probably got to play these internationals next month, because it's the playoff finals, and they'll want to get sort of that sorted. And the national organisations are in pretty much a similar boat financially to what a lot of teams are, say, in the EFL, where they need these games to keep going. A lot of them rely, you know, on gate receipts and various other sort of incomes. It's just not there at the moment. So, you know, I don't think anybody's playing these fixtures for the love of the Nations League and sort of, you know, keeping everybody happy. In that sense, it is just to kind of keep the cash flowing. And I think it'd be very difficult to kind of turn that tap off next month. Although, as I said a little bit earlier, I mean, I struggle to see how they should be going on at the moment, because it just is going to spread the disease. And I think we've already seen that considerably, you know, all around Europe. There are players withdrawing or can't play for similar reasons, in terms of either contacting the virus or sitting close to somebody who has got the virus.
Well, the Republic of Ireland manager Stephen Kenny was asked about the future of these international games at his press conference today, and here's what he had to say.
This game will be the last game. All right. I don't think so. I don't think it will be, no. I think it's difficult to be certain, but I think in life there are challenges, and society must exist, and you must try and overcome hurdles in your life or in society. You know, I think it's important that history has taught us that it's thrown up many challenges throughout the ages, and I think we've always had to overcome obstacles, and sport is an important part of life. People need something to look forward to, and the Irish national team are very important within Irish sport and life, you know, hugely important. And I think it's the pinnacle of sport in life in Ireland, you know, the Irish international football team. And I think along with other sports, but it's a special, very special place in the hearts of the Irish supporters. And I think so it's great if it does continue. You know, obviously we've had setbacks and people have to review that, but it's, you would hope it's good news if it continues, and that's for sure.
It sounds like there will be a lot of reviews to come. Now, let's turn our attention to Project Big Picture. So for anyone that doesn't know, this plan was put together by Liverpool and Manchester United and would see teams in the EFL given £250 million right now to share between themselves. They are in serious trouble and need a big bailout. And then they would get 25% of revenue from future TV deals that the Premier League secures. It sounds good, but like everything, it comes at a price. In exchange for this, then, the football calendar would be trimmed to suit the top Premier League clubs, and the number of Premier League teams would be cut to 18. The Carabao Cup and the Community Shield would be abolished, and this would free up fixtures that could be filled with big European games. But the most contentious point, and the one that is causing a lot of debate, is that the Big Six, which are Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City, Arsenal, Spurs and Chelsea, would also get special voting rights on certain issues, along with West Ham, Everton and Southampton. So it is quite complex, and to go through this, Mark Langdon is going to stay with us, and we're also joined on the line by former chairman of Leicester City, John Holmes. John, just given your involvement in Leicester for such a long time, what's your reaction to this potential plan?
It was seen as a bit of a power grab by the top elite, for some years before that, the bigger clubs, Manchester United, Liverpool, were the two clubs at the pinnacle then, and have remained so, that they had always threatened to break away, go into a European league and so on, and felt they should get a bigger slice of the revenue because their gates were bigger, their world following was bigger, and so on and so on. And it's in that sort of context now that we look at it, that the Big Six, as they've now become, for those who don't know, that would be constituted by Manchester United, Manchester City, three from London, which would be Tottenham, Arsenal and Chelsea, and the other club, Liverpool. So it basically out of two areas, the northwest and London, they would be seen to be controlling the game. Now, the one thing I should say is that not everything in these proposals is of course a bad idea. I personally am in favour of reducing the league down to 18. At the moment we suffer from fixture congestion, and this does give our clubs problems when they go into Europe, and we obviously want our clubs to have as good a chance going into Europe as the other sides do. The sharing out of the revenue to the EFL clubs is an extremely good idea, because a lot of those clubs are very, very close, given the current circumstances. They were in financial trouble before, but now, of course, with no gate money coming in, they're in real trouble. The suspicion is, of course, that this is a power grab, and that what the top six clubs are trying to do is to make it so that it will become very difficult for them not to be in the top six. They'll have a lot more revenue and so on and so on, and they'll be able to dominate the game.
John, obviously the basis of this proposal has come from Manchester United and Liverpool, who are American-owned by Fenway and the Glazers. Is this an American model? Are they trying to turn the English Premier League into maybe what the NFL or the baseball, into the models they run on?
Well, there's a critical difference, Ruby, between American sport and, as we know it, sport in the rest of the world. That is, in the US, the leagues seem to have the power. They have the whip hand. Most of the clubs, or franchises as they are there, are subservient to the league. They hold the rights and they hold the power. What has happened over here is that the clubs hold the power. The Premier League, if you look at it, has nothing like the power that the commissioner of the of an American of a US soccer league, soccer or baseball or gridiron or whatever. The commissioner there has big power, and the power is more centralised. Over here, it's the power is held by the clubs, and that's a big difference. I think American leagues are sealed, of course. They don't understand, or they don't really go for promotion, relegation. What we've got here in England with the Football League is a series of cliffs. If you fall off one cliff, i.e. fall out of the clubs that qualify for Europe to being an also run, you lose out of a lot of income. If you fall out from being part of the Premier League into the Championship, you lose a lot of income, and so on down the pyramid. And of course, there's a lot of difference between the ownership models of the big clubs and the ownership models of some of the smaller clubs. In the first place, I believe that English football leagues grew because of their association with communities. All the clubs were community clubs in the to start with, but as this became as it opened up and ownership was taken by abroad, and when it became clear that the marketing rights of English soccer were so valuable all around the world, one of the reasons they were so valuable was the competitive nature and the difference of the clubs. We've never actually been dominated by one club, as in the case of in Germany. If you look, Bayern Munich have won the league for the last umpteen years, and they seem to win it by the end of February. In Italy, Juventus have won the league for the last nine times. In Spain, it's either Barcelona or Real Madrid. Nobody else gets a look in. In the 1950s, of course, prior to the Premier League, 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, the honours were fairly spread about, but in recent years it's become more concentrated in the top clubs.
John, can you see a way of stabilising English football and safeguarding the future of all these clubs that are struggling without going for this deal?
It's very difficult to see. That's why I say there are a lot of good proposals. I dare say that if this were put to the remainder of the Premier League clubs on the basis that the voting will remain the same, that is to say it requires two-thirds majority of the 20 clubs, i.e. 14, to get matters passed and make changes, then I think a lot of these proposals would be seen as a very good thing, and they do seem to go some way towards supporting the pyramid of English soccer, which is so important for the nurture of new talent and so on and so on, and also for its marketability. I would say this as a Leicester supporter and a chairman, but it was my feeling that Leicester's incredible 5,000-1 win in the Premier League helped the marketing of the Premier League around the world. It was, I know from my own experience, what a big impact it made in the US and what a big impact it made in Australia and all around the world. Everybody appreciated an outsider coming in and breaking up the pattern.
So if Rick Parry at the EFL convinces people that this project is the way forward, can you ever see another Leicester City winning the league?
If this project went through as it stands, I think it's most unlikely. It would make it even worse odds than 5,000-1. This year so far, we have seen Everton, who've made a very good start. Aston Villa have made a good start. Leicester have made a reasonable start as well. And some of the bigger clubs have not made such a good start. Manchester United are struggling a bit at the moment. And I think that's the great attraction of our game, as I say, the competitive nature of it. Whereas if you look in Italy, we pretty much know Juventus will win this year. We pretty much know that in Germany, Bayern Munich will win. And in Spain, we're almost 100% certain that it will be Barcelona or Real Madrid.
Yeah, Mark just on it, a bailout of $250 million for the EFL. Do you think this is a supportive measure that they, you know, would get behind them, or is it a bit of a power grab? Is this slow poison for these teams?
It might support them for some time. Yes, it might, and certainly under the current circumstances, there'd be a lifeline. That's why I think it's worthy of consideration. I don't think we should be throwing this out. But unfortunately, there exists between the clubs a great lack of trust, so that I find it unlikely that this is going to get through. And already there are accusations being thrown around that Rick Parry has gone behind people's backs, that Manchester United and Liverpool have gone behind people's backs. And I'm afraid even between the big six, I'm not sure how much trust exists. Therefore, the chances of getting this through seem to me unlikely.
Well, I think it's going to rumble on for quite a while, John. I don't think it's going to end by the end of this week. Thanks a million for taking our call and bringing us somewhat up to date on what's going on in the Premier League.
My pleasure.
Mark, just to answer Dunica's question, what would your own view be on it?
It's the EFL clubs are drowning, so the sort of Premier League big six have got the lifeboat, and they're saying, you know, you can use the lifeboat and then start asking for loads of demands, to make sure that they can be saved. I think it's some of the proposals are right, but the power grab is, it's really, I think, in bad taste. And I also think that they've really sort of missed the mood of most football fans, and also I think a lot of teams in the Premier League. It feels unlikely to go through. I can't see most of the Premier League teams voting for it and just handing so much power to the big six, where they'd be able to decide whether an owner was sort of fit and proper to run what could be a rival football club. That seems just bonkers, really. And of course, the main reason that they want to do this is to create more room in the fixture list, because they want to expand the Champions League, and they also want to have more friendly tournaments sort of around the world. So I'm not even sure it's to ease the fixture congestion. It's just to put the fixtures into other places. I'd be surprised if it got through, and I'd just be hopeful that the Premier League can help the EFL out in other ways that doesn't distort the competition too much.
It is a kind of a situation that COVID is making. It's a desperate situation for people, really, because they don't feel like they have choices. And I think that goes to football as well, when we see the lack of fans and also the lack of a plan for fans to come back. Anyway, speaking of fans, if I was a fan of Salford, Mark, I'd be pretty happy if Roy Keane was going to be my next manager.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Manchester United connection there with the owners, a very ambitious team in League Two. I mean, we're talking about sort of EFL clubs not having much money. That doesn't really apply to Salford, because they've got Peter Lim, a billionaire businessman who also owns Valencia, sort of pumping in some of the money, and then it's the class of 92 that are sort of got the other half of the club. So no problems there in terms of Salford being able to see out the season. I think Alexander, the coach that's just left the club, was always going to find it difficult if they didn't make a really fast start. If Roy Keane, I'd just be a little bit wary of sort of Roy Keane in League Two, because he does seem to get frustrated when even sort of the best players can't sort of live up to his expectations.
And of course, possibly go wrong.
Exactly. So he may have to sort of, I suppose, lower his expectations of what the players can and can't do.
Can you really see the class of 92 bossing Roy Keane around?
That would also be very interesting. I'd back Roy Keane to kind of have it out of any of them in sort of any debates over transfers. I don't think the Gary Nevilles would be meddling in sort of which players were arriving at the club. Let's put it that way.
I doubt it very much. Mark, there are a load of international games on tonight, so a bit of fun, I'm going to put you on the spot. Okay. I'm going to get you to call them all. Germany and Switzerland, Mark. Give our listeners something to look forward to tonight.
Okay, yeah, Germany to just edge it by a goal.
Ukraine and Spain.
Oh, again, tight one, Spain by one goal.
Azerbaijan and Cyprus.
Draw.
Draw, oh my God. And Montenegro and Luxembourg.
Oh, Montenegro.
He's judging you here, by the way.
Yeah, like, I'm right down, Mark. I'm going to remind you of this next week. Faroe Islands and Andorra.
Faroe Islands.
Latvia and Malta.
Draw.
And the last but not least, Liechtenstein v San Marino, the highlight.
Liechtenstein. I mean, San Marino are the worst team in world football.
Well, I have all that written down, Mark, to remind you of next Tuesday night to see how well you came and ever went. Thanks, William, for taking our call. Enjoy yourself.
Thank you.
Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Game on 2FM.
I'm having a sticky fingers day today. I can't seem to press the right buttons at all. Yeah.
No,
I'm not drinking Fanta in studio. Don't get me in trouble.
We won't be giving out to you. Donnie can wait when we go off air, but I won't say a word, I promise. Today did see the resumption of the Giro d'Italia. After a rest day yesterday and a whole pile of COVID cases, there was teams withdrawn and teams staying in. Michelin, Scott and Jumbo Visma both pulled out of the Giro d'Italia. But stage, I think it was 10, was won by Peter Sagan. And joining us on the line to talk about it now is Declan Quigley. Declan, how are you?
Hey, Ruby. Yeah, not too bad. Yeah, all good here.
Where are you?
I'm in Rimini, Marie. We've just arrived north. We're in Tortoreto down on the seaside on the Adriatic earlier on today, and then we blasted north to Rimini for tomorrow's stage. So it's all seaside stuff at the moment, and it's a bit crazy. It's a funny old race so far. We've had fantastic bike racing. One of the best stages of Giro d'Italia I've ever seen today. Peter Sagan got the win, former world champion. Epic encounter, but of course the events before the stage kind of dominating a lot of the talk, and then it's been a little bit peculiar, to say the least.
I was listening to the chief of the tour earlier on Eurosport, and he seemed pretty confident that this race will get all the way to Milan. Do you share his optimism?
I kind of do, really. Mauro Venni, the race director, has a very experienced man. He's been at the helm of this race for many, many years. And the race will go on. That seems to be the attitude. And there's a lot of support for the race in Italy. They want the event to continue. Having said that, it's a difficult time. The current situation is that, we lost two teams today. The Mitchelton Scott squad had already lost a few days ago Simon Yates, their their team leader. And then they had four staff members that tested positive on the rest day yesterday for COVID-19. So they made a unilateral decision to pull out of the race because they just had too much COVID in amongst the squad. But all the teams are in sort of separate bubbles, and they have pretty serious health protocols that they're all adhering to and have been for months at this stage. So they stepped out. Then Team Jumbo-Visma pulled out. They had their lead rider, Stefan Kreisvik, tested positive. So he's out of the event, and they decided that it was the right thing to do for the team and for everyone involved that they would pull out as well. Michael Matthews also tested positive for the Team Sunweb squad, but that team has decided to stay in. They're perfectly entitled to. And Benny has said he'll test any team that has any association with COVID every day until such time as, you know, the race ends, whenever it ends. But currently there is a lot of optimism that we are going to get to Milan.
Just from following the Tour de France, it seems like there's a huge increase in positive cases. What's different this time?
Tour de France had no positive tests throughout the race. It was radical. It was extraordinary that it even got that far without any positive test in what is a sort of a fairly large number of people travelling around relatively close proximity. I don't know is the straight answer. Having said that, it's probably fair to say that there's a huge level, a much, much higher level of COVID in Europe in general, you know, compared to July. So it's sort of ramped up in every country. And all I can say, I suppose, is that the riders that have tested positive so far have displayed no symptoms whatsoever. So they haven't felt particularly unwell. So it's been disappointing for them, for everyone involved. But from a health point of view, at least, they are immediately isolated. They're removed to a separate location. And, you know, that they're separated as quickly as possible from any further integration with the race.
Declan, you mentioned two of the kind of favourites having to pull out. Surely that's made it a thrilling event now and wide open for anyone.
Yeah, it's been a mad old Giro in many ways. Kreisvik is a bit unfortunate. He ran into a snowdrift in 2016 when he was leading the race. He had crashed out. And if it wasn't for bad luck, he'd have no luck on Giro d'Italia. Simon Yates led it for 13 days 2 years ago, and ultimately dropped out of the lead with a few days to go. So he thought he was going to be able to solve his problem this year. Unfortunately, he said. Having said that, the riders that we still have in, there's a young kid called João Almeida, Portuguese guy from the Sam Bennett's Decoining Quickstep squad, and he's performing out of his skin. He's been in the lead now for 8 days and has been able to respond to everything that's been thrown at them. But the Italians have their favourite, Vincenzo Nibali. He's an old stager now, 35. He's won this race twice in the past, and he's looked really, really strong.
Declan, you said today was an amazing stage, Peter Sagan. I was watching it in the driving rain, and he was miles clear. What made it so epic for you?
It was like a one-day race. It just was on all day. It never stopped. I mean, we barely got time to take a coffee while we were, you know, we did like the flag every day, 4.5 hours of broadcasting. Some days, I don't want to lie, it's actually a little bit of a chore to try and get through some of the longer days where there wouldn't be a lot of action for several hours. This one was on all day. The time flew. And Sagan got into a group of seven up the road. They got a gap of around about 40 seconds. And he and his seven were chased by the Groupama FDJ squad. Arnaud Démare is leading the points classification. He didn't want to let Sagan get any points and close up his advantage. So they just went toe-to-toe. Uphill, down dale, sawtooth profile. There were loads of horrible little climbs. I actually rode a couple of them today, and they're really, really steep, short, sharp shocks of climbs. Throw in the weather, and you had a situation where Sagan was literally only 20 seconds ahead of a tiny group of favourites at the end. Bodies all over Italy, literally. They were coming in for ages afterwards on what was expected to be a relatively straightforward medium mountain stage, but it just turned into quite an epic battle.
Of course, we became very enthralled in the sprint jersey for the Tour de France. Today's race only worth 25 points to Peter Sagan and not the 50 because it was a mountainous stage. Has he a chance of claiming that title? It's a different colour jersey, in Giro d'Italia.
Absolutely. And, you know, Arnaud Démare was kind of a little bit annoyed that he didn't get to go to Tour de France. And his team, Groupama FDJ, decided to put all their eggs into the general classification basket with Thibaut Pinot, and it didn't work out for them. But Démare is a pretty good sprinter. he does really well on the really flat days, but when it gets a bit grippy and into the climb, Sagan's able to last, as we saw on Tour de France. And Sagan seems to be showing no ill effects from his 3 weeks around France. He's recovered well, and he seems to be getting stronger and stronger as this race goes on.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're having a great time anyway. We're not one bit jealous about it. I don't care how many times you say it's a chore. We will not believe you, Declan Quigley. Enjoy the rest of it and stay safe. Thanks so much for taking our call. Before we head off, Ruby, I didn't get to chat to you about Enable yesterday, the news that she's retired.
Yeah, she has. I think it was an inevitability, Marie. I thought she was always going to retire after the Arc. There had been a chance she was going to run this Saturday in Ascot in the Champion Stakes, but that hasn't materialised. She's headed off to Stud, where she has a date with Kingman, who was also owned by Prince Khaled Abdullah's Judman Farm. So that'll be exciting for them. But look, she was a wonderful racehorse. She ran, 19 times, won 10.5 million, 3 King Georges, 2 Prix de l'Arcs, a brilliant win in the Breeders' Cup when she beat Magical, 2 Oaks, a Yorkshire Oaks. She was an incredible filly, and every sport needs superstars, and she has definitely flown the flag in flat racing the last couple of years. She was just an incredible filly who stayed in training much longer than most flat horses do. She'd be missed.
You make Stud sound like Love Island for horses.
That's basically what it is, Donica.
Brilliant recoupling. Brilliant stuff. We're back tomorrow at 6. We have Ireland versus Finland, all the action from that big game, and Jason Sherlock's also joining us, and we'll be keeping an eye on Ruby's accumulator with Mark Langdon, see how that went. Tara Short is up next.